This is me and Don Thiel and his wife Joan. Joan edits his books. I read the manuscript and had some ideas about it, and also noticed grammatical mistakes and things like that. So note the dropouts, if there are any. Oh, that didn't work. Note the dropouts, the discontinuities that I'm talking and then you don't hear the punchline for some reason. Okay, here we go.
The McLuhan album that Nelson put out, you know, dedicated to me, is from Nelson's own tape recordings in McLuhan's class.
Oh, that's interesting, because
it might not matter what time you do it.
Anyway, Montgomery did mention that. The other interesting thing was some stuff about Wilfred Watson's cliché to archetype and the copyright problems.
Oh, so that I'll have to. Well, I always read everything, so I'll get to that. But is that the main thing that's new that you're...
This is what interested me most, yeah.
Right, because there's something about 2001 going on.
Oh, yeah, well, that was kind of... I'd heard that the same stuff on the radio, the TV, you know, the debate between those who say the millennium is 2000.
Oh, is that what that's about?
2001, and then, of course, you get into calendars and mysticism.
It's always finicky. It always spirals off.
Yeah, so it goes on and on, but it's all along that line.
Oh, it's about that topic of the date. Okay.
Yeah, it's all about the topic of the date. Whether you have a celebration on January 1st, 2000, December 31st.
Yeah. Well, you know.
2000 on January 1st, 2001. You know.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing about this. If I read it, it's interesting, and I go, my God, am I wasting my time? So I try to do the yoga. I try to do a kind of media yoga here. It's hard to do.
Yeah.
It's interesting how you get involved in this thing. Then it's never going to lead anywhere. It's going to digress.
Yeah.
So then what's the point? So it's almost like always dealing with Finnegan's Wake.
I think the best thing to do is to declare both years of millennium. Then you have a double big bang.
Okay, so...
So how's everything else?
Fantastic. So let me start. First off, Don,
mm-hmm.
your book.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, we have a book that, when it comes out, I can tell Nelson, you have a book to give to your kids that they can understand what happened
mm-hmm.
and where it comes from. We now have an official book to begin to look at McLuhan.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's tremendous, what you've done.
Well, I'm pleased because that's what I tried to do.
Right.
Not what it worked.
No, I mean, if someone wants to go off into science or theory or whatever else in their own world, they first deal with what that was, what McLuhan was, the real McLuhan and the virtual McLuhan. You know, the McLuhanism is the virtual McLuhan in a way, right?
Yeah, and quite a way.
Right? And then also virtual can mean this is the virtually what he was from your experience.
That's right. There's a choice in pun in it.
That's right. I saw it as a pun, so that's good. And so, 10 deities, you know. Well, actually, no, that's not. It's 2 deities. Is one by means of 2.
Yeah.
I guess, yeah, there's 2 virtual McLuhans.
Yeah.
And 1 phenomenon and 2 versions.
That's right.
Yeah. So that is 10 deities.
I think so.
And so so you lay it out there, and so people now know what the ground is, and then from there, Mark Derry can go on his rant about McLuhan's anti-Semitism, whatever, if he wants to emphasize that, but they got to know what happened.
Yeah, yeah.
And so you really lay it out. Another thing is that the book is, after reading it, I looked at the rearview mirror, and I was noticing how much of it that is in the medium as a rearview mirror. And I was saying, this is really a redoing of the medium as a rearview mirror, the same issues, but with the perspective of 30 years of what happened to the virtual McLuhanism,
and what
you found out in your own understanding of McLuhan.
That's, again, quite true, because one view Ted and I share is that Marshall pretty much closed shop after about 70, you know, in terms of developing a lot of newness.
That's right. Okay.
Most of the ideas like the tetrads there before and all that stuff.
Right. And personally, I mean, when I send the manuscript back, I'm going to send you the talk I gave to Lance,
uh-huh.
and, you know, with Richard, which is what the talk I gave a talk, uh-huh. but that was the oral version of what I would write. So I wrote it out after.
Uh-huh.
And what I wrote, you're going to find very interesting in light of what you wrote. In light of, like I say, I stand on your shoulders. And
right.
Now, I push it. I go into some, maybe, a new zone. It's going to be very interesting, your reaction to what I write. But a lot of what I say is what you say.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I work with that. So I'm going to send you a copy of my speech with the long version with the 104 quotes and then the short version, but mainly the long version is what you would go through.
Yeah,
and a copy of the audio of the speech.
Great. Are you going to mail this?
Yeah, I'll mail it all up to you.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, so then, so it was really interesting to read through your book and see how much we understood this. Like, much of what you wrote about, I understood and have always worked with that. That's probably why I tell you that I stood on your shoulders.
Yeah.
Probably Medium is a Rearview Mirror, when I read that in the 70s, got me looking into those areas.
Uh-huh.
And then I developed that, and then I created something in the 80s. And I'm also going to send you my two albums because I'm the guy who's been you. I'm doing what you asked for. I was using Finnegan's Wake on the radio show, the Finnegan version of McLuhan, as the McLuhan Interest Service in the late 80s, early 90s.
Oh, good.
That's what I did.
Uh-huh.
And so also, I'm sending the albums to you because I want to see how they fit into your paramodern concept.
Okay, great.
Because the paramodern is the diversity of all these different mixed media on the micro and the macro scale, right? Isn't that
uh-huh.
what paramodern is?
That's right.
Like
yeah.
parallel things.
Yeah.
Which is better than post or bimodernism.
Yeah, it's sort of beside, above, beyond, all together.
Yeah, that's right. What I call holopathic retrievals, holopathic cliche probes, all resonating around going nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the resonance of replays in the pentad reality.
That's right.
Yeah, so all right, so I'm going to just show you some general themes are written, like McLuhan, on an envelope here. My first overall thing is a lot of what you say
uh-huh.
in your book is an argument that you had with McLuhan, starting with the thesis.
That's quite true.
Right.
But an argument I didn't understand I was having until
that's right.
20 years later. You know.
Right, like...
Well, yeah, I mean, it unfolded very gradually.
Would you it's an argument you understood while doing the Medium as a Rearview Mirror?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so by the late 60s, when you got to Montreal...
Oh, yeah, well, I understood it. I mean, you know, over time in Toronto, but, you know, it wasn't, like, instantaneous.
Right.
The whole thing was apparent to me in 1954.
Yeah, but that is what we're... The whole issue of him bringing in Lewis, and then here you are 40 years later pointing out the difference between McLuhan, between Lewis and Joyce as satirists. And that is what, temperamentally, you couldn't go with McLuhan on that,
mm-hmm.
and intellectually and all the different levels. But that is interesting that your thesis is the beginning point, and you're still, and you had worked, you knew a lot of the stuff you write in your books, you knew in the 50s, you know, academically.
Oh, right, yes, I did. I mean, I didn't have a lot of time in the 60s and the 70s.
That's right.
In the 80s, I was an administrator a lot of the time, you know.
And it's going to be interesting to see what some of the scholars make out of the fact that you actually, supposedly, created some of the insights, the appealing that your study with him triggered off some of his approaches. You were right there.
Yeah, and these were good examples of, you know, the kind of collaboration and research where you bounce ideas back and they grow, if you know what I mean.
That's right. So I was saying that you and Joan, that was note number one. Note number five, you and Joan were the first victims, first members of the McLuhan cult.
That is quite true, I think.
I mean, you can send stuff to the cult awareness gang that goes around busting cults. You guys are sending this book in a way as an exposure of the cult of McLuhan and how it began.
That's just about right.
Is Joan listening?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, you agree, right, Joan?
Interesting theory.
Yeah. But it is not that, I mean, I think McLuhan, I agree that he went into, he created Tom Wolfe on purpose. He had to translate himself in all these different media.
Uh-huh.
And he also had to create a cult as part of another medium.
Oh, very consciously and as part of himself.
Right.
So I don't know about whether he created Tom Wolfe or not. He was sort of...
He created having Tom Wolfe be his mentor, his
distorter. He said, I want to be translated into the magazine world. I'll let Tom distort me as much as possible because that will show that the that's me via the magazine as opposed to me in person or in a movie or in books. Like, I think he consciously used the media, as much as he intuited, allow the media to warp him as an example of how one's image gets altered.
Yeah, and I think he used Feigen and Gossage to get Wolf.
Right.
And, you know, I don't think they solely thought of that.
No, they didn't. And that, I think that your book has insight that leads to what I'm saying. You imply that Marshall was consciously playing with these guys and allowing them to play with him, but he was a little more on top of it than the world and they expected.
Yeah, quite. Quite.
But it may have snowballed beyond even what he expected.
Oh, it certainly did. That's a different issue. But,
right.
But he,
okay, so
he was as much sinning as sinned against.
That's right. So your book, in a way, it's kind of satirical because you're aware of what happened to you. You don't have real bad feelings on understanding what McLuhan did, but you are pissed off at all the other people who didn't know how the cult started and should understand what the cult is.
Yeah.
So it's a satirical exposure, in a way.
In a way, I think that's fair.
Yeah. Okay, another point is that, you know, it was Huxley's book, Island, where you have to find out who, in fact, you really are.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, in the end, you have always been a university person,
uh-huh.
And you represent the university and the university curriculum, and it's the pressures on it and how it should respond and how it should be updated. You are, to me, constantly speaking as a university professor, as that medium, in relation to all the other effects of McLuhan.
I think you're fair there, too.
Right.
And I think that's another part of the quarrel, probably in some way.
Yeah, what is the role of the university? Because at this point...
Yeah, I don't think it has to cut itself off.
Right. That's right. And so Marshall was partly would agree with you on that. He was trying to update the university or to make it adapt as an institution to the new media takeover of journalism and all that.
Yeah, I agree, but I think that he also sold it out a little bit too much.
Yeah, because he had such broad agenda. I mean,
the corporate, you know, I have a chapter in the rearview mirror about Aretino and the,
right.
And the Renaissance period and the kind of corporate gesture, and I think that was a very real problem.
Yeah. So and you're right, and that reminds me, he definitely was a figure for a ground, a symptom, and from reading that book, and I always worked on this principle, but I have no trouble saying that McLuhan was the greatest poet of the last 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
In such, because he covered so much ground that it's more long-lasting.
Well, the last 50, I was going to say, okay, yes,
in the second half, it's McLuhan.
Poets have not been very, we've not had many great poets in the last 50 years.
No, but McLuhan figured out a way to do it past Joyce, but that's because he understood Joyce the best.
Yeah.
And so Ginsberg and all these guys, they don't know this. You know, they don't know that they were competing with a great poet or that they didn't even include McLuhan in their world. But that's the unique thing that your book does.
Yeah, the nearest you come to people in other languages, you know, Beckett and Borges. And
what about John Cage?
Well, that's not a poet. That's different.
That's a musician.
But
Baudrillard recently said, it was posted on C Theory, talking about McLuhan, that he considered McLuhan a musician.
Well, you know, you can... The other thing about this is all the arts are blending and have been for over a century and a half now, so there's...
That's right, and Joyce did it with The Wake, and then McLuhan understood that, and then he's the greatest poet because he included all the arts.
Yeah.
You know, he was all the things. Hindu chants or something, but none of that has the formal dynamics of McLuhan in the broadest vision.
Yeah.
I mean, where he could become head of the United Nations and orchestrate a global classroom. You know what I mean?
Yeah. The trouble is that Lands people and the Postman people are going to hate this. You know.
That's right. What you're showing, I'm thinking the poets don't know it, and then the regular academics.
Yeah.
Okay, so then...
Well, some of the poets did, and not so much the poets, but some of the filmmakers and artists in the 60s.
Do you want me to get you some water?
That'd be nice, yeah. You know, some of the filmmakers and artists and stuff.
But see, they came and went. McLuhan, his work stands stronger than anything that Stan Vanderbeek or anybody made.
Yeah.
So in terms of you being the university administrator and representing that, who's going to do anything about this? This is what rereading Ted Carpenter's his exploration thing. He says you and Cameron set up the MK Ultra thing. It didn't work. We have an alternate theory of brainwashing. Let's work with that.
Uh-huh.
He's throwing that out. You're implying let's do this, and they're publishing your books. But who is there any program that should be organized, or you just hope professors read your books and they filter?
I just hope somebody. I mean, I organized enough things. Actually, I organized a program very few people know about in New York in 1965. They really began to do this kind of thing.
And is that program still going?
No. It lasted my lifetime in New York, 1 year.
And then you did it in Montreal.
Well, yeah, but the one at York was remarkable. We had Ray Moriama, Patrick Watson.
And you had Arnold Rockman.
Baron Brainerd. We had a faculty in the one seminar of 17 people.
Wow, that's a seminar of 17 faculty?
No, 17 faculty. There were 30. What we did was we handpicked people. Well, we let people apply, but we took them from right across the spectrum, media, government, university students, university faculty, and then we had this faculty or research group for the seminar, and so there were altogether perhaps about 50 people in this thing.
But you're including faculty?
Yeah.
So you said 17 faculty members.
About that.
For one course?
What?
For one course?
Oh, the course was fairly expensive. it was experimental. It worked very well, after all, you know, and people, it happened right in the midst of 7 days, so, of course.
Right.
And Watson was involved in it.
Oh, I forgot about that. See, he was doing 7 days at the same time.
Oh, yeah, sure. We were using pre-edited footage, rushes from 7 days, and having people, you know, work through how you would have edited it differently from maximum and minimum. And I have a huge file on this. I'll show you sometime.
Oh, that's incredible. Is this a, when you say you have a course, it hits more than one class content?
No, it was just a course in the evening.
It was a seminar that met once a week.
It was a seminar that met once a week in the evenings, 4 hours in the evening.
This is what Ted calls the round table of the 50s, the CBC Energy in the early 50s. He does in his article that Toronto uniqueness, you guys did that in with the same people almost in the 60s in the university.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, media analysis with multidisciplinary dialogue.
Oh, and a lot more, you know, I mean, it was really, really far up my life.
And Marshall knew about this. Tory and UT,
yeah.
And he couldn't get anything going, and you're going on, and you went on to make
thanks to it.
Yeah. Okay, that's one thing is this, and is it necessary? Because the world's a classroom now, but...
Probably things. One of the problems with the university today is it's been so governmental, industrial, bureaucratic mode.
Yeah.
That it becomes very hard. New university.
Yeah, because...
I by that I don't mean anything facetious over time.
Right, because when Frank Zagroni approached Nelson in the middle of the 80s, Nelson Thal, always there, he's now on the board of the Torstar, when I first met Nelson, he said, you know, I want to create a place where we can send. I always think that he's there with the money at some point that we can do, set up a place. He understood that the program would change, but at least it's a place where knowledgeable people can get together. Things.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and then maybe create cultural products out of it. So that's, which what I think is somehow since long, there must be something being worked out here that will happen. That will, and we've been collecting works for years from different sources to prepare. Here I have Marshall McLuhan's Finnegan's Wakes. You know, Xeroxes that no scholars like O'Grady and them can get to because Eric won't let them into Marshall's private library. So here I've got stuff that's very valuable. And it has a quote from Key Page in Finney's Wake by Marshall with his footnote. This is stuff no one has access. There's a reason for using it. So I'm wondering how we, how you can be part of this. Because you're in.
When you get up here next time, let's talk about it.
That's right.
It'll take a few hours.
Well, who's going to take it over? Have you planned on anything on that?
Nothing is bad, you know.
So it could end up at the Faculty of Information Studies, or...
It could.
Okay. So then the next thing I have here, I should tell you about Ted. The version you have,
uh-huh.
I checked with my Robert Fulford published version. He had sent me the...
Uh-huh.
And I think the one he did for you may even have a little more than the...
Do what I want with it, but I wouldn't do anything until he'd read the whole manuscript.
Right.
The only thing that was done...
What happened is I'm reading it. That was the one of the last things I read.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, because I read Chapter 11. It came up that were relevant to my own paper, so I called them to ask. Now, you know, the feminists would love to know that the founder of media theory is Dorothy Lee.
Yeah, I'm not sure she always catches on.
Right. So we went through a lot of stuff about Dorothy, and I'm not telling him that I have it, right?
Yeah.
So he goes... He says, but, you know, he's written this up.
Oh, yeah.
So I'm warning you because... So he went on a bit of a rant about how that... He goes, that fucking country. He says, those guys... And he went into side stories about...
I think he's got the Canadians read all wrong.
That's right.
You know, I mean, that isn't what it
He's never understood it.
No, he's never been understood by the Canadian. I knew Ted would have problems, but I didn't think it was with that part necessarily.
Yeah, it surprised me. I
read in Canada, which at least parts of it by one of the actor.
Right, John, you told me. Who was that who recommended that?
It was Bill Toy. It was very interesting.
Okay, because...
They said they were really interested in looking at... after the Menippean satire and before the... That would have secured. Evans chapter is the thing with Menippean satire.
Right.
And then after that, there's just the short conclusion.
So would you keep that the conclusion?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't think that through. This is too new an idea to me, so I really haven't thought it through yet.
Yeah, just instinctively, you might want to put the conclusion. Yeah, it's hard. I think that maybe the conclusion should be the conclusion, because that's a way of getting out of whatever personal ramifications the appendix has. Beg your pardon?
Yeah.
Okay. So then, though I'm just thinking that maybe the conclusion itself still goes into issues about Lewis and things. So I don't know. That's difficult, isn't it?
Yes, it's going to be a problem. That's why I stuck it as an appendix, because it really is important, but it doesn't exactly fit into the other material.
Right, because I worked out the numerical order here.
Yeah.
You've got 14 chapters. I mean, 12 chapters plus two appendix makes 14. The odd numbers begin with personal stories. The odd number chapters I know begin with personal stories, and the even numbers begin with climate, what the climate McLuhan was operating in. And then I have also said the odd numbers are the general, that's the general ground of McLuhan, that's the climate. The even numbers are McLuhan as figure and response, as well as, so it's interesting, I have two ways you've organized it. The odd number chapters have a general ground or climate for McLuhan. The even numbers have McLuhan as figure and response. And yet the odd number chapters begin with your personal story, a personal story.
Uh-huh.
So the personal story begins the chapter that's going to talk about the general ground that McClone operated in. The other chapters that don't begin with a personal story, what I call the climate chapters, they actually deal with McClone as figure in response to the general ground. So there's two figure grounds there. And then chapters 11 and 12 are reversed in this system. And then Carpenter's is an additional personal chapter. So that's, I just noticed that. So the numerical thing, you want to keep the 12 chapters probably numerically as a number.
Well, I'll have to think all this through.
Okay.
That's a new idea. That was a very new idea. But anyway, I'm intrigued by Ted's response.
Right. Yeah, it is surprising and interesting. So I wanted to tell you, warn you, that the espionage worked. We found out what he's thinking before he tells you.
But he's obviously interested in the other thing.
Yeah, we didn't talk, he didn't really go on. I think I asked him what he thought of the book in general, and I don't remember him saying anything. He just went on, and he just was too distracted by the appendix.
Uh-huh.
So maybe when I call him back, I'll get another take from him.
Yeah. No, I'm sure I'll hear from him fairly soon, anyway.
Right. Okay, now there's some other notes here. Let's see. One thing, I have written here more, there should be more backup to the French theory chapter in terms of when you list all these different guys and how they've used McClone, you might want to give a quote or two from each one of them. Or, like the general themes of ecstasy and, well, there's the Baudrillard themes and then there's themes from the others.
Uh-huh.
There's no proof that they did follow, that the themes there.
Okay. Yeah, that I can do. Yeah.
Yeah, there's,
and that's a good idea.
Yeah.
You know.
More proof, more examples from those postmodernist guys that echoes McLuhan stuff that you've laid out.
Uh-huh.
That's what. And I have here Montreal 67 is good image. It's incredible that McLuhan is in Montreal 67. It's in Quebec. And the French are getting Gutenberg Galaxy and all that stuff coming, going to be translated.
Yeah.
That here is Marshall in Montreal, and it's going to then affect French culture.
Uh-huh.
That's really a good, important chapter, important image of him there with you and his influence on that, and that it all takes place in Quebec, which resonates over to France.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's
very,
really,
and, you know, and of course, Jacques Langevin,
yeah,
who I mentioned, and that was the was one of the chief designers of the multimedia exhibitions in the Man in the Community pavilions.
Right. That's what I loved about your book is that you give a little more detail about Le Guerin's book, which I have a Xerox of, but I have to have it translated for me. And you at least went into it a bit, which was good. I would have liked more on Le Guerin, but it's not an issue. I'm going to have to talk to him or find out how to read the stuff more in his book. You know what I mean?
He always wanted an English translation.
Yeah.
I can translate it for myself well enough, but I could not.
Yeah, I haven't read French for years.
I'm not good enough at it to be a translator. Anyway, he could never get a... publish it, you know, but...
And also, one aspect of your book, you know, the statement that all criticism is autobiographical.
Yeah.
A lot of this book is your own story, and you're talking about your own network of friends. And
there's a strong autobiographical element in this, that very thing.
Right. And in fact, that's why I think I'm in there.
Yeah.
I'm someone you met, you appreciate it, so you put me in there.
Yeah, well, I also, you've done some things on it that I think are important.
Right, I really appreciate that you mention me in there and cite me in relation to Eric's thesis. So the Montreal 67, now what is really an interesting point. And now I think we're going to go into the details in a second, the corrections. First, what is incredible about your book is the first to analyze McLuhan's work as one big prose poem and show the interlacing of the themes and the Finneganese style of the figure ground alterations of, like, the theme acoustic space, how it moves through. This is the first time anybody's ever done this with McLuhan.
Well, I think it's largely because people that had an impact like Ong deliberately concealed this.
Yeah.
They wanted to make it reduce it to an academic theory so they could theorize it, but...
You show the ground. They wanted to make it a figure without a ground.
Yeah.
And but it was really a pleasure to read, you know, someone reading. I mean, I've noticed that and watched that through the years. If you read a lot of McLuhan stuff, you will begin to see that. And it's very interesting how he changes the concepts and just like Finnegan's Wake. It's HCE, the same HCE going through changes, but remaining HCE from the beginning. And it was a real pleasure to read the poetry of McLuhan's work. It really was exciting. I think that's, for now, that's that. So let me, now, I've got a page here with 53, when I send you the manuscript, I circle every little screwed up comic, or comma, every missed period.
Oh, that's good. It doesn't seem like speed, but I did this in 5 months.
Right.
Is very
Arnold, you did that in July, August, September, October. You did it in 5 months, sorry.
Maybe four to five months. And I think once Carol's computer, the little peak line, it shows mistakes, right? Do you have
That's right. I have the same thing.
So you'll have little underlinings on what you have, but maybe having me the visual version that you can compare to, it'll clarify what the thing is underlying or something, why it's underlined.
Yeah, and some of course, you know, those red things don't underline because there are lots of mistakes you can make that they don't.
Yes, like the wrong date.
Yeah.
We can go into the wrong information they don't underline. So anyways...
The wrong date he died.
The wrong dating what?
The date he died is wrong.
I don't know about that. But anyways, the thing is that... I check off the right-hand side, so the check mark means a mistake in that line.
Yeah.
So it was quite fetishistic. I went through every line.
That's what helps tremendously, you know, because it's so hard to, you know.
Right.
After a while, you begin not seeing double.
That's right. You get tired and you miss things. Okay, so let's begin. Let's just see how long this takes. And I'm going to go through some of the notes. You might, maybe I'll just Xerox the page, and then you can understand it if I say it now. Like, I begin with page Roman numeral 10. I have 1948. You have McLuhan coming to St. Mike's in 48. Should be 46.
Yeah.
Often, note your date. You often have 48 rather than 46 for some reason. And another thing is in Carpenter's, I asked Carpenter when he met McLuhan, and he thinks he met McLuhan in 48, which means you weren't involved in introducing him. Do you think he's got that wrong?
I think so.
Yeah, because I think
he might have met him in the sense of met him.
Around the scene, but he never dialogued with him until you brought him together.
That's right.
Yeah, because he does this debate with Fry in 49, I think he says in 49, and that isn't the conspiratorial debate that Marchand talks about that Marshall orchestrated, is it? You got to check Marchand's biography.
Oh, no. The conspiratorial debate wasn't. Well, that was done, that was done as part of the English club at Anatomy of Criticism came out in the year Anatomy of Criticism came out.
So who did he get to debate him? I don't think Marshall.
He's a good friend of mine. That was Fred Flav.
The guy who's reading your book now?
Yeah.
Name?
F-L-A-F-F? A-H-I-F-F, yeah.
P-H-I?
F-L.
Flahif. F-L-A-H-I-F-F.
What race is that?
Well, French, actually, originally, but he came well connected to the Catholic hierarchy in Canada. Is Cardinal Archbishop of Winnipeg.
Okay.
And the other, another cousin.
Okay. So you say there were four guys that Marshall orchestrated against Fry?
Well, I don't think he orchestrated all four, but he encouraged behind the scenes the setting up of the
Flaff one.
Yeah. Oh no, of the whole to... I don't think he set up Fred's being involved particularly. I think he just set up, you know, sort of needle people into having the meeting, and then the graduate students got together and chose people to do it.
And he didn't participate in it. He just set it up so that there was...
I don't remember. I mean, he would have been there, and I'm sure he participated in the discussion later, you know. I mean, I don't think he participated actively, no.
Were you there?
Mm-hmm.
You witnessed
yeah.
it. But it was him trying to confront Fry.
I think indirectly,
yeah.
But then we all were trying to do that, you know. I mean,
right.
In 1965, when I was at York, I invited Bill Wimsatt to Toronto to talk in the city to English teachers and at York to the people, because Wimsatt was one of Fry's major critics.
So... So you had Wimsatt to go after Fry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fry and I were always close friends. This was...
Right. I know it's all within friends. It's an academic debate. Yeah.
Yeah, well, yeah. Some people accept this more easily than others.
Right.
Nor he did.
Okay.
Okay, I think there's a gap here. Let's move it forward.
At the conference, that nobody... Gordon, more or less, in quotes.
Okay, I just move it back and we'll wait till it gets there. I don't know when these gaps are going to happen. Coming up any minute. Still waiting. Still waiting.
Do you have the manager there? Joan? Bellius Convalesce, and in quotes, patently offensive pornographic wit of James Joyce. Are you quoting McLuhan there?
No.
Look at the source of who said patently offensive pornographic wit of Joyce.
Yeah.
Were you just generalizing, Donald?
No, I don't think so.
In quotes.
You
should have had a source then.
I think Bob's right about the source. I'll just have to check.
What's the source, McLuhan?
Yeah.
Something he wrote way back. You know, wasn't it? It was in Terrence Gordon's book. He has a quote from a paper I don't think I have from the early 40s where McLuhan knocks Joyce as part of the tribal time cult or something. You might want to check that source in Gordon.
Well, there are two or three. There's a letter, a letter I quote that in the. It was probably 46 at my.
Yeah, the Black Mass. No, I know that, but there's a quote.
But
earlier.
There's a couple of letters in that period that go over that kind of thing.
That are in the book.
Yeah.
Yeah, but no, the one in Gordon, he lumps Joyce in with jazz or something. And it's an interesting. You check that the Gordon note because
yeah.
I didn't recognize it, and I thought, well, that's good to know. He's saying it's interesting. It's very early, like I think 40, 41, or 42, or something. So that's interesting in light that when he meets Lewis in 43, he assumes Lewis is the character, Mackenzie in The Self-Condemned, is portrayed as a guy thinking Lewis was one of the superhuman agents, like Joyce, you know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
And then he realizes that Rene Harding is not that, and then they become friends. So you might want to compare, just check that. Now, the next on page 12, you X2, you have Winnipeg. He was born...
in Edmonton.
Yeah, the third person, people told him that.
Yeah. Now, people reading it told him.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that shows you how rushed you were in writing this.
Well, no, actually, I just plain forgot that, you know.
Okay.
I knew his mother and father and family, and I always thought of him as Winnipeg, but I realized, you know.
Right, okay. So it's like a habit. It's an old habit image
yeah.
you have.
Yeah.
Okay, moving on. Have you ever seen Drucker's book, Adventures of a Bystander?
No, that one I haven't seen.
Definitely get it because he has a long essay on McLuhan and Bucky Fuller, where McLuhan presented a paper that basically said the meeting was the message.
Okay, that's interesting.
That's really interesting, and I don't know Drucker says it and puts it in this biographical book. So you, Adventures of a Bystander, you want to use the message. But he made the point at the conference that nobody understood of the printing press had more effect than anything that was printed inside the books. That kind of
well, he could have said that early because a lot of this comes from the ideas of on form and content in Richard's
right.
30s and
well, and that backs up what my paper says. When you receive my paper, you'll see what where I put it in. Okay. So I just want you to be aware of what Drucker said.
Uh-huh.
On page XVI 16, you talk about, just check that, it's the, and I actually have these kind of things written in the column, like I'll have your cliched archetype, but it doesn't spell it out, but you talk about Pound, artist and tenant of the race, possesses the empathy to register motifs that respond to those significant moments that reveal the agenda of an era, thus presumably serving society as an early warning system about a social political unconscious. Although McLuhan would scarcely have spoken of such an unconscious in quite this way. Now read page 200 of Cliched Archetype in the second paragraph from the top, where he discusses Coleridge's primary and secondary imagination and says that the relationship between the echoes of the stages of apprehension from the creative process and vice versa, and how that is echoed in the unconscious, the degree of awareness of that makes it difficult to determine whether the private awareness is influencing the collective unconscious or the collective unconscious is influencing the private awareness. It's a very interesting quote, a paragraph, that might, the only time I see Marshall touch on what this idea is.
Yeah.
All right?
Yeah.
Appreciate architecture. Do you remember what? Do you think you know what I'm referring to?
Uh-huh.
So, page 200, Cliched Archetype. The next thing is Terrence Gordon has two R's in it. You've got one R all the way through it. It's
oh, well, that's probably just a Freudian unwillingness to come to terms with it. Yeah, okay.
T-O-R-R?
No, T-E-R-R-E-N-C.
Oh, Terrence.
Yeah, Terrence.
Yeah, any Terrence always should have two R's.
Yeah, and definitely the other Freudian thing is Mady Molinaro. It's not Molinari, it's Molinaro with an
yeah.
O.
Yeah, that I'm pretty sure because I know her husband well, yeah.
Yeah, no, but you have it as I when
yeah,
you mention the book.
Yeah, I.
Because you don't want the very people going after say, you didn't even get my name spelled right.
Oh, no, well, thank you.
Right, and then the next thing is Laws of Media is not the Laws of Media.
Okay.
There's no the in the title.
Yeah.
And pointed out. He says, we didn't want the because we don't want to be definite. It's suggestive, so we just have laws of media.
That's Freudian again, too, because there should, you know, there might as well be the there, you know what I mean?
Because the way they do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's your, maybe you're sticking that in there like that, but you don't want to have that in the book because it looks stupid.
I agree.
That's an issue they make. No the. Now, of course, what it means, I was telling Carolyn that the last word in Finnegan's Wake is the. That's why they don't want the, because they're continuing Finnegan's Wake, and the next words would be laws of
Yes.
So that's the way, okay, so get rid of that the, just so that they can't say you misread it.
Okay.
And in page XX, the 20, the last line, but the accompanying feature of such a serocomic, this is the middle of the page, but the accompanying feature of such a serocomic or satiric approach is that the writer's work necessarily becomes complex, ambivalent, and transgressive or rebellious. Okay, you're talking about this particular tradition. Somewhere in Nash's thesis, in the thesis, he talks about that Nash represented the wild conservative tradition, that there was the wild faction in the conservative people, in the rhetoricians.
Yeah, I remember. I'd forgotten that. I remember this.
You might want to, if you can find it, because I've scanned I can't find it. I haven't looked real closely, but every now and then I said, I wish I had it, and I look, and I can't find it. But it's in there somewhere because I read it years ago and noted it. That might be something you want to asterisk and show how McLuhan knew this in his thesis.
Yeah, well, that's very interesting.
Right, because that explains his Nietzschean anarchy part. You know what I mean?
Oh, very much so. Well, I'd always thought of the Nietzschean as tied up with the Renaissance interests he had at the time.
Right, so if you find that, I mean, I don't know if that's the exact words, but then my memory is the wild conservatives, wildness that Nash and these guys did, even though they were conservatives. They were, mirroring the anarchy they saw around by the other factions. So that's an important thing to check. All right. Okay, now we go to XX.
Yeah, I will. That's a very good, very good, very
yeah.
interesting point.
And then XXI4, I have here McLuhan's agenda in Hot and Cool. All right, there's something. XXI4. Right. McLuhan and Carpenter, two-thirds down, actually embrace most of the major... okay. Perhaps even more important, these topics partly generated by the faculty collaborating on the project. Oh, yeah. When you write culture and communications, the seminar,
mm-hmm.
you have communications singular. I notice Carpenter has S on communications.
I'll have to check on that because I think it was culture and communication. That was in the 50s, a fairly important debate. Not among that group, but I mean outside. Because communications referred just to the technological
right.
area of things.
And communication refers to effects, so to speak.
To the whole range of things.
Right. So you've got singular all the way through the book. But you better check what
I'll check on that, but
yeah.
I think it probably is culture and communication.
Yeah, and it's probably second nature, because that was the title you said for years when you were there, right?
Yeah, and you know, it would be actually much more inclined. I'll look and see.
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
Because you do, I think, at the beginning of the book, somewhere, so make sure that's correct. So anyways, I just spun off on that. So perhaps even more important, the faculty collaborating on the project actually embraced by the mid-1950s. In Hot and Cool, I remember him saying that they stopped doing the pressures of putting out a periodical and being on time. That say he said we decided to stop the periodical and write books,
uh-huh.
which means they're just translating the agenda into another medium.
Uh-huh.
So it confirms your statement that they were just carrying on what he had down in the 50s.
Yeah, that's right.
So check that it's in the Hot and Cool interview.
Uh-huh.
And,
what page is that?
Oh, I know. I got it, 24.
The XX...
10 pages.
Yeah, XXIV.
Yeah.
24 in Roman numerals. And, so I have... When you get the manuscript, you'll see I put a little wiggle by that, and I'll put HNC, meaning Hot and Cool.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see, okay, now XXVI. VII, so that's like 27. This would be relatively unimportant. It's just a word there. If I have circled a word and put a question mark over it, I don't know if you've got it wrong or not. It could be correct in the sentence, but recheck the sentence. You may have meant the opposite.
Okay.
Because the first time I thought it was wrong, then the second time I thought, well, no, maybe that's right.
Fine. Okay. It'll do, but I'll have to wait till I get you.
Yeah. So you'll see the circlings of just a little circle where there's punctuation. But if I put a circle and a question mark, that means the sentence, the thought is not clear.
Uh-huh.
Or is it what you mean? And let's see, XX, the last of the intros, XX, the 30, XX, X32, XX, 32, your last line, he's a contemporary learned trickster who was able to envision the drive and thrust toward the close of the second millennium, and it was also a symptom of the emergence of the new global city that is rapidly moving beyond media. Now, I understand your beyond media theme. I even have that paper that you and Joan wrote in the late 80s, you know, McLuhan and Beyond Media. I understand he was he created the disease and offered the cure. He's satirizing media, but you might want to clarify that the internet, even though it's beyond what people call media, they say the internet frees us from the media.
Yeah. Oh, I know.
I
will clarify that.
Yes.
Well, not on this manuscript, but I mean just with respect to the title of the...
Of that. Yeah, because you could, on a tetrad on the internet, the World Wide Web enhances the feeling of what media feels to be liberated from.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the media, people think the media is the news, and therefore they think they're free of the media. But then they get confused and would reject McLuhan. They don't want to see McLuhan on Understanding Cyberspace. And they don't understand that, no, that media includes...
That's really the catch in all this, is it?
That's right. So people have pointed out to you... No, not in the book.
I've used it in other essays and talks and things that people have raised.
Right. Okay, so that...
But, I mean, you know, I knew that, but that isn't the point. You know, the point is before.
Right, and that's very important. That's the co-anesthetic and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Media means.
Uh-huh.
And then what you mean. Okay, now that's the end of that introduction. Then I have page 4. I notice often I'll underline a book title when it's not underlined, or you might
check it.
Right, and your yellow line
is probably a matter of my bad computer press.
You see a line in this manuscript, I underline a title, I'm underlining it because it didn't have the black line under it. And then I have, on page 4, I just thought it was wrong, checked it off, made a bunch of lines, and I write beside it, this is okay, meaning ignore my correction. Okay, now you're sure Pound's quote is literature that stays news, not news that stays news?
Yeah, literature is news that stays news.
Yeah, because I always knew it from Marshall as news that stays news.
No, yeah, literature, yeah. It isn't literature, it stays news. Literature is news that stays news.
All right, so
left out.
I think I put a question mark there just to check... question mark whether that is real or not, and you probably know better than me, so
no, that's wrong if it's that way.
Yeah, you have literature and you're right to have literature.
Mm-hmm.
So I just put poetry question mark.
Oh no, it is literature.
Okay, good. And then the next thing, are you sure? I always thought in my mind there was one reference to Innes in Understanding Media. Now you have the CD-ROM, so you can check it that way, right?
Yeah, that's how I checked it.
And it's not in there.
Anything. What I did, I'll recheck, but I what I did was do a total search, and that's what it turned up.
Well, that's great, because I always thought he was in the city, somewhere in there, like the Paper Roots chapter or something. In my mind, I always thought he quoted...
Well, I'll check. I looked on,
I couldn't find it.
They're Innesian ideas, but Innes is not, you know, I mean, I...
Yeah, he's not named.
But I was surprised when I did that. What I did was just take the names and go through a search, you know, thing in the using the Voyager CD-ROM.
No, that's good. So you're probably right, but it's a surprise because I knew he wasn't featured a lot, but I thought at least he was once in there. And in my mind,
I thought that was very intriguing, because when he moved from the academic or the Canadian audience to an American, hopefully non-academic audience, Innes disappeared.
That's right, and that proves your point.
Yeah.
Yeah, that it was an academic friend. Now, he does mention Innes in Joyce Mallarmé and the Press back in 53.
Oh, yeah.
And that reminds me, you've got Trivial and Quadrivial was 1954. I think they're in It's Your Landscape. That's 53 also.
Okay, I'll check that. That could be because...
See, what's interesting, he did the two Joyce essays in 53, and he did the Wyndham Lewis one in 53. He wrote both angles in the same year.
Good God, did we do all of them? I mean, you know, this is the period I lived through him with intimately, and I think I couldn't believe that it all came out in that year.
Yeah, that you read the articles when they came out, and he just poured it all out. And that was after Innes had died, and then when he made his move.
Yeah, and basically... He started reading Innes in late 51, 52, around that.
Yeah, when he saw it mentioned in The Bias of Communication is the story he tells.
Yeah.
The Mechanical Bride. Okay, so Innes, one reference, you may be right, but double check that. I couldn't find Innes. A Moral Observer, okay, page 13. The Amoral Observer, somewhere in there you're talking about, the page 13, The Mechanical Bride, and a few years later he shifted to acting as an amoral observer of the emerging contemporary technoculture. He really lays out in Explorations number 8, he talks about the idea is not to react. We're studying these things without reacting, and he italicizes it. But that's the exploration strategy, but he does say a sentence like that in Mechanical Bride.
Oh, yeah.
You know, he said later that it was too moral, Mechanical Bride, but actually if you read carefully Mechanical Bride, he's presenting he says he's being amoral, he's not reacting to these things.
Yeah, but you can find both of those in Mechanical Bride.
All right, you get both.
Yeah.
All right, so you might want, that you want to clarify, because a close student in the future is going to say, no, he's amoral in the Mechanical Bride. You know, cite the sentence where...
Okay, I know where other...
Yeah, good. Because I remember years ago when I said, well, look, he's saying right here, it's a detached strategy here. So, it's not really that amoral.
Oh, well, if you mean detached, yes. But if you mean not with a moralistic... argument.
Right.
What he was really saying is that there's a moralistic argument in the in the Mechanical Bride, which he doesn't use elsewhere. The Poe thing, the Maelstrom thing.
That's detachment.
Is a detachment, but it's not. But it's a detachment to allow you to observe, and then after the observing, make a moral judgment. It's the same sort of strategy that he picks up from Addison and the Spectator papers and that sort of thing.
Yes, after the say that again, after the detachment.
After the detachment, then you make a moral judgment.
Yeah, you take a moral agenda.
In the Bride, you certainly make moral judgments. I mean, you know.
Okay, well, that's on page 13. You should put a footnote and clarify that.
I will do that because it's very important.
Yeah, what's the difference between amoral and detached? You know, and did he really make a shift? And I think you're right the way you've just explained it, that he becomes a simulacrum later. You know, he becomes the process. He's not being moralistic about it.
Mm.
He realizes he can't get moralistic about it, even though that is a strategy that has a moral agenda, but it's really removed.
That's right.
Yeah. So on page 15, I have Playboy. I think you've got the wrong date. It's March 69 is the technical date for the Playboy interview. You have 1968. It may have been done in 67, 68. You know, it was the actual interview, but it was...
No, I think that's a mistake.
Yeah,
I think you're right. I remember it as 69 when you say it.
It's printed in March 69, and then the next issue, April, had the big interview with hedonistic Ginsberg.
Yeah.
It's interesting they put McLuhan in, and then Ginsberg, the next issue. You have Wired started in 91, started in 93.
Are you sure about that?
Oh, yeah. I was in Venice, California. We had moved to the States, and
I heard about it. I thought I checked. I have the first issue here.
When I come to your house, I want to see the first issue because I've only got the Xerox of the Camille Pagd. I've never seen the whole issue. And I like to know, what is the first quote they have by McLuhan in the first issue?
Oh, well, it's something from the media. Medium is the massage.
Okay. Someday,
but they cite it as the medium is the message.
Yeah, that's how quickie they were. I mean, you know how Rosetto discovered McLuhan. He says, well, I've got a gig here. I'm making a magazine. What can I put? And he looks through his bookshelf, sees medium as a massage, says, oh, yeah, that looks cool, pulls it out, hadn't read it in 20 years, 30 years, and says, oh, this is great, McLuhan, yeah, okay, let's put him in.
Well,
it was all off the top.
It was bound to happen. The ghost is always there.
Right, but the thing is that the guys, these were not guys who studied McLuhan for 5 years, says, yeah, this guy needs to be revived. He's done on the spur of the moment.
Well, that's a great story. I wish I'd known it.
Yeah, well, okay, stick it in there if you want.
Can we document it anyway?
It's probably the New York... I'll check my files. It was in some magazine story on him.
If you can, I'd love to.
I have the New York Times magazine story in 95 or so, 94.
Yeah, that is a wonderful story.
Okay, I'll try to find it.
I didn't know it. That's magnificent.
Right, I'll try to find that. And, so it's definitely 93. It's January, February, March. It's early 93, because I was in there, and definitely not 91.
Okay. I'll check again anyway. Yes.
Okay, so then I have here, just right, page 19, no footnote.
Where was the Wired thing?
Oh, that's page 19.
19.
Okay, page 19, at the bottom, you have footnote 18. Change quote is changes, dangerous, and threatening, but you have no footnote in the footnotes, in the notes section.
Okay, we'll check that.
Yeah, there's no footnote.
Oh, that's one of those ones you hadn't filled in, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, you might not have known what it is.
No, there were just a number of footnotes that I left to do later.
Right. Well, there's one there, you say, you don't put anything, but here you kind of know your source. You put number 18, but then you don't say what it is. Now, page 26, such a conscious counterpointing of his work with Innocence, which did not appear in his previously published writings, shows that he was quite conscious of having made advances beyond Innocence. In fact, that his building on Innocence was partially a strategy for gaining appropriate response for his own work in Canada, in particular at the University of Toronto. I think you're referring to the letter to Kuhn, where he really goes after...
The one about... Yes.
Let me see. Is that Kuhn?
Kuhn's, yeah.
Yeah, Yeah. Now, here's what I got beside it. I have the in my files, I was going to check this before I called you, but I forgot. I think he does the later Innes in 53. Have you ever seen that? The later Innes done in 53.
Yeah, I saw it when he did it.
Okay. Yeah, you were there. You saw him writing it?
I saw it in typescript or...
Right.
You know.
I know the intro... The bias of communication comes out in 64. They reissue it with an intro by McLuhan.
Mm-hmm.
Which I noticed in the new bias of communication that's out in the 90s, they got rid of McLuhan's introduction.
Mm-hmm.
Because McLuhan's introduction points out that Innes knew nothing about finning his wake in the arts.
Mm-hmm.
That's in the 64 introduction. Now, I've got to check my file.
You mean the UT Press drops it between 64 and 90, yeah?
Yeah. I think Murray bought it. That's right. He bought the 90s version. I looked at it. I said, look, I want to show you what McLuhan says. And there's no McLuhan.
Murray won't believe you now, I'm sure.
I got caught in that one.
Yeah.
But the thing is that... We know in 64, so it's before Kuhn's, he points this out, and he may have written it, I'll check it, in 1953.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, were you aware of that?
I would have been, but I could easily have forgotten it, if you know what I mean.
Right, so you would need to...
Virtually everything, you know, I mean, the way Marshall worked, virtually everything in that period, he give me to read, or we talk about it.
Right, you knew it personally, but I'm saying, you may want to have this as a footnote to this sentence to show that it's even before Kuhn.
Oh, yeah, that's okay. I, yeah, oh, yeah, 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 yeah.
You're saying by 71 he's showing this, but you're implying that that's the...
Yeah, I'd forgotten, and of course we talked. I mean, that's how Ted and I both know about it. Marshall wasn't that interested in Ennis in the early days.
Right. And see, this is December 6, 71. Back in March, he has a big... His biggest breakthrough is in March 71.
Yeah.
And it's a letter to someone, to Bissell, biggest discovery of your life, and he goes on about...
Well, that was so much crap, because he knew that
years earlier.
I mean...
That's the satirical part of McLuhan, is that he kept calling up people saying he had this big discovery, and if you knew his work, he had it 10 years before, or 20 years before. So
yeah.
Why was he doing that? Is he losing his memory, or was he just being satirical?
Well, after 67, it's hard to say.
That's right.
I mean, really, when I was with him in Expo in 67, I didn't know, you know, anything about his illness. But I was just amazed at his, I don't know how I'd put it, but, you know, his mental state. It was kind of lapses. It was unawarenesses.
He didn't have that hard tension that his mind had before. That hard edge.
I was very interested in linguistics for a period. It was almost aphasiac at times.
Right.
And of course, that was real. I didn't realize it when we were together, but of course, if he had that sort of brain tumor with that kind of pressure, and of course the operation was just, you know, shortly after that, he would have been having aphasia and other problems from the pressures.
That's right, and that reminds me, I don't think I made this yet. I know I noted when
I didn't include this kind of thing because I just don't particularly know how relevant it is in any way. Gordon and people like that go into that sort of area of the thing.
Right, I've got to look up. I just remembered I didn't make a note in my... These are 53 notes from my review of what I did before when I went through all the stuff. I've got... What's the chapter of McGill? What's the title? French Theory one, right? Is that the...
What are we talking about?
The one where you talk about meeting you at Expo. That would be Power and Cultural Production?
I can't remember which chapter it is.
Okay, I'll look.
But I can tell you in a minute. I have the whole thing. I have the whole set of them here on the computer so I can just do a quick search.
Yeah, we're looking for the Expo chapter.
Mm-hmm. Okay, but go on with another point and I'll...
No, I need to...
Okay, wait a minute. I'll have it in a second.
Just get the table of contents, Donald.
No. Oh, is it in the table?
Yeah, I've got it.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I didn't realize that.
Is it Shaming an Artist, Chapter 8? No, it must be 7, The Forerunner of French Theory. Okay.
That's it.
Yeah,
you start out with Expo.
Yeah, so here's what you have here. Did I note this? Page 134. Oh, I do have a note. Okay. You say massive brain tumor, which he was to have surgically removed in a dramatic and lengthy operation the next year. No. You saw him in, like, the summer of 67?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's not. It's 67. He has the operation in November 67.
Was it that early?
That early.
I thought it was 68.
No, he's back in Toronto by the summer of 68.
Really?
That's when the coach house is built. The coach house is prepared for him while he's at Fordham.
I'd forgotten that because, you see, I would have seen him, Bob, in probably August, the last time in August, late August of 67.
Is that when you're sitting above the Expo and looking?
Yeah, I think, you know, I mean, I'm not sure, but roughly I would have thought of it from everything that was going on late August.
The thing is that the coach house 30th anniversary is in 98, 30 goes back to 68, and I know that Arthur Porter built the coach house, so it was there for Marshall to come back from Fordham in the summer and fall of 68. And I definitely know the date. It's November 23rd, 4th.